wildly, trying to get it off before I smothered. I emerged, blinking and panting, to discover that I was naked. I glanced at my pallid, sagging, skeletal remains and snatched the sheet up over myself. Jamie was bending to collect my discarded gown, petticoat and jacket from the floor, adding these to the shift he had folded over his arm. He picked up my shoes and stockings and added these to his bag.
"You," he said, pointing a long, accusatory finger at me, "are going nowhere. You are not allowed to kill yourself. Do I make myself clear?"
"Oh, so that's where Bree gets it," I murmured, trying to stop my head from swimming. I closed my eyes again. "I seem to recall," I said, "a certain abbey in France, and a very stubborn young man in ill health, and his friend Murta, who took his clothes in order to prevent his getting up and wandering off before he was fit." Silence. I opened one eye. He was standing stock still, the fading light from the window striking sparks in his hair. "Whereupon," I said conversationally, "if memory serves, you promptly climbed out a window and decamped, naked, in the middle of winter." The stiff fingers of his right hand tapped twice against his leg.
"I was 24, he said at last, sounding gruff. "I wasn't meant to have any sense."
"I wouldn't argue with that for an instant," I assured him. I opened the other eye and fixed him with both. "But you do know why I did it. I had to." He drew a very deep breath, sighed, and set down my clothes. He came and sat down on the bed beside me, making the wooden frame creak and groan beneath his weight. He picked up my hand and held it as though it was something precious and fragile. It was, too, or at least it looked fragile, a delicate construct of transparent skin and the shadow of the bones within it. He ran his thumb gently down the back of my hand, tracing the bones from phalange to ulna, and I felt an odd small tingle of distant memory, the vision of my own bones glowing blue through the skin, and Master Raymond's hands cupping my inflamed and empty womb, saying to me through the mists of fever, "Call him. Call the red man." "Jamie," I said, very softly. Sunlight flashed on the metal of my silver wedding ring. He took hold of it between thumb and forefinger and slid the little metal circlet gently up and down my finger, so loose that it didn't even catch on the bony knuckle. "Be careful," I said. "I don't want to lose it."
"You won't."
He folded my fingers closed, his own hand closing large and warm around mine. He sat silent for a time, and we watched the bar of sun creep slowly across the counterpane. Adso had moved with it to stay in its warmth, and the light tipped his fur with a soft silver glow, the fine hairs that edged his ears tiny and distinct. "It's a great comfort," he said at last, "to see the sun come up and go down. When I dwelt in the cave, when I was in prison, it gave me hope to see the light come and go, and know that the world went about its business." He was looking out the window, toward the blue distance where the sky darkened toward infinity. His throat moved a little as he swallowed.
"It gives me the same feeling, Sasnach," he said, "to hear you rustling about in your surgery, rattling things, and swearing to yourself."
He turned his head then to look at me, and his eyes held the depths of the coming night.
"If you were no longer there, or somewhere," he said very softly, "then the sun would no longer come up or go down."
He lifted my hand and kissed it very gently. He laid it, closed around my ring, upon my chest, rose, and left. I slept lightly now, no longer flung into the agitated world of fever dreams, nor sucked down into the deep well of oblivion as my body sought the healing of sleep. I didn't know what had wakened me, but I was awake, quite suddenly, alert and fresh-eyed, with no interval of drowsiness. The shutters were closed, but the moon was full. Soft light striped the bed. I ran a hand over the sheet beside me, lifted my hand far above my head. My arm was a slender pale stem, bloodless and fragile as a toadstool stalk. My fingers flexed gently and spread. A web, a net to catch the dark. I could hear Jamie breathing in his accustomed spot on the floor beside the bed. I brought my arm down, stroked my body lightly with both hands, assessing. A tiny swell of breasts, ribs I could count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the smooth concavity of my stomach slung like a hammock between the uprights of my hip bones. Skin and bones. Not much else. Claire. There was a stirring in the dark beside the bed, and Jamie's head rose up, a presence more sensed than seen. So dark was the shadow there by contrast with the moonlight. A large dark hand groped across the quilt, touched my hip. "Are you well, Ian?" he whispered. "Do you need anything?" He was tired. His head lay on the bed beside me, his breath warm through my shift. If he hadn't been warm, his touch, his breath, perhaps I wouldn't have had the courage. But I felt cold and bodiless as the moonlight itself. And so I closed my spectral hand on his and whispered, "I need you." He was quite still for a moment, slowly making sense of what I'd said.
"I'll not trouble your sleep,"
he said, sounding doubtful. I pulled on his wrist in answer, and he came, rising up from the pool of dark on the floor, the thin lines of moonlight rippling over him like water. "Kelpie," I said softly. He snorted briefly in answer and awkwardly, gingerly, eased himself beneath the quilt, the mattress giving way under his weight. We lay very shyly together, barely touching. He was breathing shallowly, clearly trying to make as little obtrusion of his presence as possible. Aside from a faint rustling of sheets, the house was silent. Finally, I felt one large finger nudge gently against my thigh.
"I missed you, Sassenach," he whispered.
I rolled onto my side, facing him, and kissed his arm in answer. I wanted to move closer, lay my head in the curve of his shoulder, and lie in the circle of his arm. But the idea of my short, bristly hair against his skin kept me from it. "I missed you too," I said, into the dark solidness of his arm.
"Will I take you, then?" he said softly. "Do you want it, truly?"
One hand caressed my arm. The other went downward, starting the slow, steady rhythm to ready himself. "Let me," I whispered, stilling his hand with my own. "Lie still." I made love to him at first like a sneak thief, hasty strokes and tiny kisses, stealing scent and touch and warmth and salty taste. Then he put a hand on the back of my neck, pressing me closer, deeper.
"Dinna hurry yourself, lass," he said, in a hoarse whisper. "I'm no going anywhere."
I let a quiver of silent amusement pass through me, and he drew in a deep, deep breath as I closed my teeth very gently round him and slid my hand up underneath the warm, musky weight of his balls. Then I rose up over him, light-headed at the sudden movement, kneading urgently. We both sighed deeply as it happened, and I felt the breath of his laughter on my breast as I bent over him.
"I missed you, Sassenach," he whispered again.
I was shy of his touching me, changed as I was, and leaned with my hands on his shoulders, keeping him from pulling me down to him. He didn't try, but slid his hand curled between us. I felt a brief pang at the thought that the hair on my privates was longer than that on my head, but the thought was driven out by the slow pressure of the big knuckle pressing deep between my legs, rocking gently back and forth. I seized his other hand and brought it to my mouth, sucked his fingers hard one by one, and shuddered, gripping his hand with all my strength. I was still gripping it some time later as I lay beside him, or rather, holding it, admiring the unseen shapes of it,
complex and graceful in the dark, and the hard, smooth layer of callus on palms and knuckles.
"Of the hands of a bricklayer," he said, laughing a little as I passed my lips lightly over the roughened knuckles and the still sensitive tips of his long fingers.
"Calluses on a man's hands are deeply erotic," I assured him.
"Are they, Sue?"
His free hand passed lightly over my shorn head and down the length of my back. I shivered and pressed closer to him, self-consciousness beginning to be forgotten. My own free hand roamed down the length of his body, toying with the soft, wiry bush of his hair and the damply tender, half-hard cock. He arched his back a little, then relaxed.
"Well, I'll tell you, Sassenach," he said. "If I haven't got calluses there, it's no fault of yours, believe me."
Chapter 67. The Last Laugh. It was an old musket, made perhaps 20 years before, but well kept. The stock was polished with wear, the wood beautiful to the touch, and the metal of the barrel mellow and clean. Standing Bear clutched it in ecstasy, running awed fingers up and down the gleaming barrel, bringing them to his nose to sniff the intoxicating perfume of oil and powder, then beckoning his friends to come and smell it too. 5 gentlemen had received muskets from the beneficent hand of Bird Who Sings in the Morning, and a sense of delight ran through the house, spreading in ripples through the village. Bird himself, with 25 muskets still to give, was drunk with a sense of inestimable wealth and power, and thus in a mood to welcome anyone and anything. "This is Hiram Crombie," Jamie said to Bird in Jalagi, indicating Mr. Crombie, who had stood by him, white-faced with nerves, throughout the preliminary talk, the presentation of the muskets, the summoning of the braves, and the general rejoicing over the guns.
"He has come to offer his friendship and to tell you stories of the Christ."
"Oh, your Christ, the one who went to the lower world and came back. I always wondered, did he meet Sky Woman there, or Mole? I'm fond of Mole. I would like to know what he said." Bird touched the stone pendant at his neck, a small red carving of Mole, the guide to the underworld. Mr. Crombie's brow was furrowed, but luckily he hadn't yet developed any sense of ease in Jalagi. He was still in the stage of mentally translating each word into English, and Bird was a rapid speaker. And Ian had found no occasion to teach Hiram the word for Mole. Jamie coughed.
"I'm sure he'll be happy to tell you all the stories he knows," he said.
"Mr. Crombie," he said, switching momentarily to English.
"Tsisqua offers you welcome."
Bird's wife, Penstemon's nostrils, flared delicately. Crombie was sweating with nervousness and smelled like a goat. He bowed earnestly and presented Bird with the good knife he had brought as a present, slowly reciting the complimentary speech he had committed to memory.
Reasonably well, too, Jamie thought. He'd mispronounced only a couple of words. "I come to bring you great joy," he finished, stammering and sweating.
Bird looked at Crombie, small, stringy, and dripping wet, for a long, inscrutable moment, then back at Jamie.
"You're a funny man, Bear Killer," he said with resignation. "Let us eat."
It was autumn. The harvest was in, and the hunting was good. And so the Feast of the Guns was a notable occasion, with wapiti and venison and wild pig raised steaming from pits and roasted over roaring fires, with overflowing platters of maize and roasted squash, and dishes of beans spiced with onion and coriander, dishes of pottage, and dozen upon dozen of small fish rolled in cornmeal, fried in bear grease, their flesh crisp and sweet. Mr. Crombie, very stiff to begin with, began to unbend under the influence of food, spruce beer, and the flattering attention paid him. A certain amount of the attention, Jamie thought, was due to the fact that Ian, a wide grin on his face, stayed by his pupil for a time, prompting and correcting, till Hiram should feel more at ease in the tongue and be able to manage on his own. Ian was extremely popular, particularly with the young women of the village. For himself, he enjoyed the feasting very much. Relieved of responsibility, there was nothing to do save to talk and listen and eat. And in the morning, he would go. It was an odd feeling, and one he wasn't sure he had ever felt before. He had had many leave-takings, most regretful, a few taken with a sense of relief, some that wrenched the heart from his chest and left him aching. Not tonight. Everything seemed strangely ceremonious, something consciously done for the last time, and yet there was no sadness in it. Completion, he supposed, was the sense of it. He had done what he could do, and now must leave Bird and the others to make their own way. He might come again, but never again by duty, in his role as the agent of the king. That was a peculiar thought in itself. He had never lived without the consciousness of allegiance, whether willing or not, witting or not, to a king, whether that be German George's house or the Stuarts. And now he did. For the first time he had some glimmer of what his daughter and his wife had tried to tell him. Hiram was trying to recite one of the psalms, he realized. He was doing a good job of it, because he had asked Ian to translate it, and had then carefully committed it to memory. However, oil runs down over the head and the beard. Penstemon cast a wary glance at the small pot of melted bear grease that they were using as a condiment, and narrowed her eyes at Hiram, plainly intending to snatch the dish from him if he tried to pour it over his head. "It's a story of his ancestors," Jamie said to her, with a brief shrug. "Not his own custom."
"Oh.
Hmm." She relaxed a little, though continuing to keep a close eye on Hiram. He was a guest, but not all guests could be trusted to behave well. Hiram did nothing untoward, though, and with many protests of sufficiency and awkward compliments towards his hosts, was persuaded to eat until his eyes bulged, which pleased them. Ian would stay for a few days, to be sure that Hiram and Bird's people were in some sort of mutual accord. Jamie wasn't quite sure that Ian's sense of responsibility would overcome his sense of humour, though in some ways Ian's sense of humour tended toward the Indians. A word from Jamie might therefore not come amiss, just by way of precaution.
"He has a wife," Jamie said to Bird, with a nod toward Hiram, now engaged in close discourse with two of the older men. "I think he would not welcome a young woman in his bed. He might be rude to her, not understanding the compliment."
"Don't worry," said Penstemon, overhearing this. She glanced at Hiram, and her lip curled with scorn. "Nobody would want a child from him. Now, a child from you, Bear Killer." She gave him a long look beneath her lashes, and he laughed, saluting her with a gesture of respect. It was a perfect night, cold and crisp, and the door was left open that the air might come in. The smoke from the fire rose straight and white, streaming toward the hole above, its moving wraiths like spirits ascending in joy. Everyone had eaten and drunk to the point of a pleasant stupor, and there was momentary silence and a pervading sense of peace and happiness.
"It is good for men to eat as brothers," Hiram observed to Standing Bear in his halting jalagi.
Or rather, tried to. And after all, Jamie reflected, feeling his ribs creak under the strain, it was really a very minor difference between "as brothers" and "their brothers." Standing Bear gave Hiram a thoughtful look, and edged slightly farther away from him. Bird observed this, and after a moment's silence, turned to Jamie.
"You're a very funny man, Bear Killer," he repeated, shaking his head. "You win."
To Mr. John Stuart, Superintendent of the Southern Department of Indian Affairs.
From Fraser's Ridge, on the first day of November, Anno Domini 1774, James Fraser, Esquire. My dear sir, this is to notify you of my resignation as Indian agent, as I find that my personal convictions will no longer allow me to perform my office on behalf of the Crown in good conscience. In thanks for your kind attention and many favours, and wishing you well in future, I remain your most humble servant, J. Fraser.
Part 9. The Bones of Time. Chapter 68. Savages. Only two left. The pool of liquid wax glowed with the light of the flaming wick above it, and the jewels slowly came into view, one green, one black, glowing with their own inner fire. Jamie dipped the feather end of a quill gently into the melted wax and scooped the emerald up, raising it into the light. He dropped the hot stone into the handkerchief I held waiting, and I rubbed it quickly to get off the wax before it should harden. "Our reserves are getting rather low," I said, in uneasy jest. "Let's hope there aren't any more expensive emergencies."
"I shall not touch the black diamond regardless," he said definitely,
and blew out the wick.
"That one is for you."
I stared at him. "What do you mean by that?" He shrugged a little and reached to take the emerald in its handkerchief from me.
"If I should be killed," he said, very matter-of-factly, "you'll take it and go. Back through the stones."
"Oh? I don't know that I would," I said. I didn't like talking about any contingency that involved Jamie's death, but there was no point in ignoring the possibilities. Battle, disease, imprisonment, accident, assassination.
"You and Bree were going about forbidding me to die," I said. "I'd do the same thing, if I had the faintest hope of your paying the least attention."
He smiled at that.
"I always mind your word, Sassenach," he assured me gravely. "But you do tell me that man proposes and God disposes. And should he see fit to dispose of me, you'll go back."
"Why would I?" I said, nettled and unsettled. The memories of his sending me back through the stones on the eve of Culloden were not ones I ever wished to recall. And here he was, prying open the door to that tightly sealed chamber of my mind. I'd stay with Bree and Roger, wouldn't I? Jem, Massali and Fergus, Germaine and Henri Christian and the girls, everyone's here. What is there to go back to, after all?
He took the stone from its cloth, turning it over between his fingers, and looked thoughtfully at me, as though making up his mind whether to tell me something. Small hairs began to prickle on the back of my neck.
"I dinna ken," he said at last, shaking his head. "But I've seen you there."
The prickling ran straight down the back of my neck and down both arms.
"Seen me where?"
"There."
He waved a hand in a vague gesture.
"I dreamt of you there. I dinna ken where it was. I only know it was there, in your proper time."
"How do you know that?" I demanded, my flesh creeping briskly. "What was I doing?" His brow furrowed in the effort of recollection.
"I dinna recall exactly," he said slowly, "but I knew it was then by the light."
His brow cleared suddenly.
"That's it. You were sitting at a desk with something in your hand, maybe writing, and there was light all round you, shining on your face, on your hair. But it wasna candlelight, nor yet firelight or sunlight. And I recall thinking to myself as I saw you, 'Oh, so that's what electric light is like.'"
I stared at him, open-mouthed. "How can you recognize something in a dream that you've never seen in real life?"
He seemed to find that funny.
"I dream of things I've not seen all the time, Sassenach. Don't you?"
"Well," I said uncertainly, "yes, sometimes.
Monsters, odd plants, I suppose,
peculiar landscapes, and certainly people that I don't know. But surely that's different.
to see something you know about but haven't seen?
Well, what I saw may not be what electric light does look like, he admitted. But that's what I said to myself when I saw it. And I was quite sure that you were in your own time. And after all, he added logically, a dream of the past. Why would I not dream of the future?
There was no good answer to a thoroughly Celtic remark of that nature.
Well, you would, I suppose, I said. I rubbed dubiously at my lower lip. How old was I in this dream of yours?
He looked surprised, then uncertain, and peered closely at my face, as though trying to compare it with some mental vision.
Well, I dinna ken, he said,
sounding for the first time unsure.
I didna think anything about it. I didna notice that you had white hair or anything of the sort. It was just you.
He shrugged, baffled, then looked down at the stone in my hand.
Does it feel warm to your touch, Sassenach?
He asked curiously.
Of course it does, I said, rather crossly. It's just come out of hot wax, for heaven's sake.
And yet the emerald did seem to pulse gently in my hand, warm as my own blood, and beating like a miniature heart. And when I handed it to him, I felt a small, peculiar reluctance, as though it didn't want to leave me.
"Give it to MacDonald," I said, rubbing my palm against the side of my skirt. "I hear him outside, talking to Arch. He'll be wanting to be off."
MacDonald had come pelting up to the ridge in the midst of a rainstorm the day before, weathered face nearly purple with cold, exertion and excitement, to inform us that he had found a printing establishment for sale in New Bern.
"The owner has already left, somewhat involuntarily," he told us, dripping and steaming by the fire. "His friends seek to sell the premises and equipment promptly, before they might be seized or destroyed, and thus provide him with funds to re-establish himself in England."
By somewhat involuntarily, it turned out he meant that the print shop's owner was a loyalist who'd been kidnapped off the street by the local committee of safety and shoved, willy-nilly, onto a ship departing for England. This form of impromptu deportation was becoming popular, and while it was more humane than tar and feathers, it did mean that the printer would arrive penniless in England and owing money for his passage to boot.
"I happened to meet with some of his friends in a tavern, tearing their hair over his sad fate and drinking to his welfare. Whereupon I told them that I might be able to put them in the way of an advantage," the major said, swelling with satisfaction. "They were all ears when I said that you might, just might mind, have ready cash."
"What makes you think I do, Donald?" Jamie asked, one eyebrow cocked.
MacDonald looked surprised, then knowing. He winked and laid a finger beside his nose.
"I hear the odd bit here and there. Word has it that you've got a wee cache of gems. Or so I hear from a merchant in Edenton whose bank dealt with one."
Jamie and I exchanged looks.
"Bobby," I said.
And he nodded in resignation.
"Well, as for me, mum's the word," MacDonald said, observing this. "You can rely upon my discretion, to be sure. And I doubt the matter's widely known. But then, a poor man doesn't go about buying muskets by the dozen now, does he?"
"Oh, he might," Jamie said, resigned.
"You'd be surprised, Donald. But as it is, I imagine a bargain might be struck. What are the printer's friends asking, and will they offer insurance in case of fire?"
MacDonald had been empowered to negotiate on behalf of the printer's friends, they being anxious to get the problematical real estate sold before some patriotic soul came and burned it down. And so the bargain was concluded on the spot. MacDonald was sent hurtling back down the mountain to change the emerald into money, conclude payment on the printer's shop, leaving the residue of the money with Fergus for ongoing expenses, and let it be known as quickly as possible in New Bern that the premises were shortly to be under new management.
"And if anyone asks about the politics of the new owner," Jamie said.
To which MacDonald merely nodded wisely and laid his finger alongside his red-veined nose once more. I was reasonably sure that Fergus had no personal politics to speak of, beyond his family. His sole allegiance was to Jamie. Once the bargain was made, though, and the frenzy of packing began, Marsali and Fergus would have to leave at once, to have any chance of making it to New Bern before winter set in earnest. Jamie had had a serious talk with Fergus.
"Now, it'll no be like it was in Edinburgh. There's no but one other printer in the town, and from what MacDonald says, he's an elderly gentleman, and say much afraid of the committee and the governor both, he will not print a thing but books of sermons and handbills advertising horse races."
"Très bon," said Fergus, looking even happier, if such a thing was possible. He'd been going about lit up like a Chinese lantern since hearing the news.
"We will have all of the newspaper and broadsheet business, to say nothing of the printing of scandalous plays and pamphlets. There is nothing like sedition and unrest for the printing business, milor. You know that yourself."
"I do know that," Jamie said very dryly, "which is why I mean to beat the need for care into your thick skull. But then I wish to hear that you've been hanged for treason, nor yet card and feather for no being treasonous enough."
"Hola," Fergus waved an airy hook. "I know well enough how this game is played, milor."
Jamie nodded, still looking dubious.
"Aye, you do. But it's been some years. You may be out of practice. And you'll not know who's who in New Bern. You dinna want to find yourself buying meat from the man you've savaged in the morning's paper, aye?"
"I'll mind that, da." Marsali sat by the fire, nursing Henri Christian, and taking close heed. If anything, she looked happier than Fergus, upon whom she looked adoringly. She switched the look of adoration to Jamie, and smiled. "We'll take good care, I promise." Jamie's frown softened as he looked at her.
"I'll miss you, lass," he said softly.
Her look of happiness dimmed, but didn't go out entirely. "I'll miss you too, da. All of us will. And Germaine doesn't want to leave Jim, of course, but..." Her eyes drifted back to Fergus, who was making a list of supplies, whistling Alouette under his breath. And she hugged Henri Christian closer, making him kick his legs in protest.
"Aye, I know."
Jamie coughed to cover his emotion, and wiped a knuckle underneath his nose.
"Now then, wee Fergus, you'll have a bit of money over. Be sure to bribe the constable and the watch, first of all. MacDonald's given me the names of the Royal Council and the Chief Assemblyman. He'll be of help with the council, as he's the governor's man. Be tactful, aye? But see he's taken care of. He's been a great help in the matter."
Fergus nodded, head bent over his paper.
"Paper, ink, lead, bribes, chamois leather, brushes," he said, writing busily,
and resumed absently singing,
"Alouette, gentille alouette."
It was impossible to get a wagon up to the ridge. The only approach was by the narrow trail that wound up the slope from Coopersville, one of the factors that had led to the development of that minor crossroads into a small hamlet, as itinerant peddlers and other travellers tended to stop there, making brief forays on foot upward into the mountain. "Which is all very well for discouraging hostile invasion onto the ridge," I told Bree, panting, as I set down a large canvas-wrapped bundle of candlesticks, chamber pots, and other small household belongings at the side of the trail. "But it unfortunately makes it rather difficult to get off the bloody ridge, too."
"I suppose it never occurred to Dar that anyone would want to leave," Bree said, grunting, as she lowered her own burden. Masali's cauldron, packed with cheeses, sacks of flour, beans and rice, plus a wooden box full of dried fish and a string bag of apples. "This thing weighs a ton."
She turned and bellowed, "Germaine!" up the trail behind us. Dead silence. Germaine and Jemmy were meant to be shepherding Mirabelle the goat down to the wagon.
They had left the cabin with us, but had been dropping steadily behind. Neither a call nor a meh came from the trail, but Mrs. Bug came into view, trundling slowly under the weight of Masali's spinning wheel, which she bore on her back, and holding Mirabelle's halter in one hand. Mirabelle, a small, neat white goat with grey markings, blatted happily at sight of us.
"I found the poor wee lassie tethered to a bush," Mrs. Bug said, setting down the spinning wheel with a wheeze and wiping her face with her apron. "No sign of the lads, the wicked wee creatures!"
Brianna made a low growling noise that boded ill for either Jemmy or Germain if she caught them. Before she could stomp back up the trail, though, Roger and young Ian came down, each carrying one end of Masali's loom, collapsed for the occasion into a large bundle of heavy timbers. Seeing the traffic jam in the road, though, they stopped, setting down their burden with sighs of relief.
"What's amiss, then?"
Roger asked, glancing from face to face and settling on the goat with a frown.
"Where are Jem and Germaine?"
"Dollars to donuts. The little fiends are hiding somewhere," Bree said, smoothing tumbled red hair out of her face. Her plait had come undone, and straggling wisps of hair were sticking damply to her face. I was momentarily grateful for my short thicket of curls. No matter what it looked like, it was certainly convenient.
"Shall I go and look?"
Ian asked, emerging from the wooden pudding basin he'd been carrying upside down on his head.
"They'll know I've gone far."
Sounds of hasty feet from below made everyone turn expectantly in that direction. But it wasn't the boys, but Masali, breathless and wide-eyed.
"Henri Christian,"
she gasped, her eyes flicking rapidly round the group.
"Have you got him, Mother Claire? Bree?" "I thought you had him,"
Bree said, catching Masali's sense of urgency.
"I did. Wee Aidan McCullum was minding him for me whilst I loaded things into the wagon. But then I stopped to feed him."
A hand went briefly to her bosom.
"And they were both vanished.
I thought perhaps..." Her words died away as she began scanning the bushes along the trail, her cheeks flushed with exertion and annoyance.
"I'll strangle him," she said, through gritted teeth.
"And where's Germaine, then?" she cried, catching sight of Mirabelle, who had taken advantage of the stop to nibble tasty thistles by the path.
"This is beginning to have the look of a plan about it,"
Roger observed, obviously amused. Ian, too, seemed to be finding something funny in the situation, but vicious glares from the frazzled females present wiped the smirks off their faces.
"Yes, do go and find them, please," I said, seeing that Masali was about to either burst into tears or go berserk and throw things. "Aye, do," she said tersely, "and beat them while you're at it."
"You ken where they are?"
Ian asked, shading his eyes to look up a trough of tumbled rock.
"Aye, likely. This way."
Roger pushed through a tangle of yorpon and redbud with Ian after him, and emerged onto the bank of a small creek that paralleled the trail here. Below, he caught a glimpse of Aidan's favourite fishing place near the ford, but there was no sign of life down there. Instead, he turned upward, making his way through thick dry grass and loose rocks along the creek bank. Most of the leaves had fallen from the chestnuts and poplars and lay in slippery mats of brown and gold underfoot. Aidan had shown him the secret place some time ago, a shallow cave barely 3 feet high, hidden at the top of a steep slope overgrown by a thicket of oak saplings. The oaks were bare now, and the cave's opening easily visible, if you knew to look for it. It was particularly noticeable at the moment, because smoke was coming out of it, slipping veil-like up the face of the rock above, leaving a sharp scent in the cold, dry air. Ian raised one eyebrow. Roger nodded, and made his way up the slope, making no effort to be quiet about it. There was a mad scuffle of noise inside the cave, thumpings and low cries, and the veil of smoke wavered and stopped, replaced by a loud hiss and a puff of dark grey from the cave mouth as someone threw water on the fire. Ian, meanwhile, had made his way silently up the side of the rock face above the cave, seeing a small crevice from which a tiny plume of smoke issued.
Clinging one-handed to a dogwood that grew out of the rock, he leaned perilously out and, cupping a hand near his mouth, let out a frightful mohawk scream directed into the crevice. Terror-stricken shrieks, much higher pitched, issued from the cave, followed in short order by a tumble of little boys pushing and tripping over each other in their haste.
"Oh, there!"
Roger snagged his own offspring neatly by the collar as he rushed past.
"The jig's up, mate."
Germaine, with Henri Christian's sturdy form clutched to his midsection, was attempting to escape down the slope, but Ian leapt past him, springing panther-like down the rocks, and grabbed the baby from him, bringing him to a reluctant stop. Only Aidan remained at large. Seeing his comrades in captivity, he hesitated at the edge of the slope, obviously wanting to flee, but nobly gave in, coming back with dragging step to share their fate.
"Right, lads. Sorry, it's not on."
Roger spoke with some sympathy. Jemmy had been upset for days at the prospect of Germaine's leaving.
"But we do not want to go, Uncle Roger," Germaine said, employing his most effective look of wide-eyed pleading. "We'll stay here. We can live in the cave and hunt for our food." "Aye, sir. And me and Jem, we'll share our dinners with them."
Aidan piped up in anxious support.
"I brought some of Mama's matches, so they've got a fire to keep warm,"
Jem chipped in eagerly.
"And a loaf of bread, too." "So you see, Uncle,"
Germaine spread his hands gracefully in demonstration.
"It should be no trouble to anyone."
"Oh, nae trouble, is it?" Ian said with no less sympathy. "Tell your mother that, aye?"
Germaine put his hands behind him, clutching his buttocks protectively by reflex.
"And what were you thinking, dragging your wee brother up here?" Roger said a little more severely. "He can barely walk yet. 2 steps out of there," he nodded at the cave, "and he'd be tumbling down the burn and his neck broken."
"Oh, no, sir,"
Germaine said, shocked. He fumbled in his pocket and drew out a piece of string.
"I should tie him up when I was not there, so he shouldn't have wandered or fall. But I couldn't have been leaving him. I promised Maman when he was born. I said I would never leave him."
Tears were beginning to trickle down Aidan's thin cheeks. Henri Christian, totally confused, began to howl in sympathy, which made Jem's lower lip tremble as well. He wriggled out of Roger's grasp, ran to Germaine, and clutched him passionately about the middle.
"Germaine can't go, Daddy. Please don't make him go."
Roger rubbed his nose, exchanged brief looks with Ian, and sighed. He sat down on a rock and motioned to Ian, who was having a certain amount of difficulty in deciding which way up to hold Henri Christian. Ian gave him the baby with a noticeable air of relief, and Henri Christian, feeling the need of security, seized Roger's nose with one hand and his hair with the other.
"Look, Awalach," he said,
detaching Henri Christian's grasp with some difficulty.
"We Henri Christian needs his mother to feed him. He's barely got teeth, for God's sake. He cannot be living up here in the wild, eating raw meat with you savages."
"He has too got teeth,"
Aidan said stoutly, extending a bitten forefinger in proof. "Look."
"He eats pap,"
Germaine said, but with some uncertainty to his tone.
"We would mash up biscuits for him with milk."
"Henri Christian needs his mother," Roger repeated firmly. "And your mother needs you. You didn't expect her to manage a wagon and 2 mules and your sisters all the way to New Bern alone, do you?"
"But Papa can help," Germaine protested. "The girls mind him when they mind no one else."
"Your Papa's gone already," Ian informed him. "He's ridden ahead to find a place for you all to live once you've got there. Your mother's to follow on with all your things. Roger Mac's right, Awalach. Your mother needs you."
Germaine's small face paled a little. He looked helplessly down at Jemmy, still clinging to him, then up the hill at Aidan, and gulped. The wind had come up and blew his blonde fringe back from his face, making him look very small and fragile.
"Well, then,"
he said, and stopped, swallowing.
Very gently he put his arms round Jemmy's shoulders and kissed the top of his round red head.
"I'll come back, Cousin," he said, "and you'll come and visit me by the sea."
"You'll come too," he assured Aidan, looking up. Aidan sniffed, nodding, and made his way slowly down the slope. Roger reached out a free hand and gently detached Jemmy.
"Get on my back, Mokushla," he said. "It's a steep slope.
I'll take you down, Pickaback." Not waiting to be asked, Ian leaned down and picked up Aidan, who wrapped his legs round Ian's middle, hiding his tear-streaked face in Ian's buckskin shirt.
"Do you want to ride too?"
Roger asked Jermaine, standing up carefully under the weight of his double burden.
"Ian can carry you, if you like."
Ian nodded and held out a hand, but Jermaine shook his head, blonde hair flying.
"No, Uncle Roger," he said, almost too softly to hear. "I'll walk."
And, turning round, began to make his way gingerly down the precipitous slope. Chapter 69. A Stampede of Beavers. October 25th, 1774. They had been walking for an hour before Brianna began to realize that they weren't after game. They'd cut the trail of a small herd of deer, with droppings so fresh that the pellets were still patchy with moisture. But Ian ignored the sign, pushing up the slope in single-minded determination. Rollo had come with them, but after several fruitless attempts to draw his master's attention to promising scents, abandoned them in disgust, and bounded off through the flurrying leaves to do his own hunting. The climb was too steep to permit conversation, even had Ian seemed inclined. With a mental shrug, she followed, but kept gun in hand and an eye on the brush, just in case. They had left the ridge at dawn. It was well past noon when they paused at last on the bank of some small and nameless stream. A wild grapevine wrapped itself round the trunk of a persimmon that overhung the bank. Animals had taken most of the grapes, but a few bunches still hung out over the water, out of reach for any but the most daring of squirrels, or a tall woman. She shucked her moccasins and waded into the stream, gasping at the icy shock of the water on her calves. The grapes were ripe to bursting, so purple as to be nearly black, and sticky with juice. The squirrels hadn't got to them, but the wasps had, and she kept a cautious eye on the dagger-bellied foragers as she twisted the tough stem of a particularly succulent bunch.
"So, do you want to tell me what we're really looking for?" she asked, back turned to her cousin.
"No," he said, a smile in his voice.
"Oh, a surprise, is it?"
She popped the stem and turned to toss the grapes to him. He caught the bunch one-handed and set them down on the bank beside the ragged knapsack in which he carried provisions.
"Something of the sort."
"As long as we aren't just out for a walk, then."
She twisted off another bunch and sloshed ashore to sit down beside him.
"No, not that."
He flipped two grapes into his mouth, crushed them, and spat the skins and pips with the ease of long custom. She nibbled hers more daintily, biting one in half, and flicking the seeds out with a fingernail.
"You ought to eat the skins, Ian. They have vitamins."
He raised one shoulder in scepticism, but said nothing. Both she and her mother had explained the concept of vitamins numerous times, to little or no effect. Jamie and Ian had reluctantly been obliged to admit the existence of germs, because Claire could show them teeming seas of microorganisms in her microscope. Vitamins, however, were unfortunately invisible, and thus could be safely ignored.
"Is it much further, this surprise?"
The grape skins were, in fact, very bitter. Her mouth puckered involuntarily as she bit into one. Ian, industriously eating and spitting, noticed, and grinned at her.
"Aye, a bit further."
She cast an eye at the horizon. The sun was coming down the sky. If they were to turn back now, it would be dark before they reached home.
"How much further?"
She spit the mangled grape skin into her palm and flicked it away into the grass. Ian glanced at the sun, too, and pursed his lips.
Well, I should think we'll reach it by midday tomorrow.
We'll what? Ian!
He looked abashed and ducked his head.
I'm sorry, cuz. I can't, I should have told you before, but I thought you maybe wouldn't come if I said how far.
A wasp lighted on the bunch of grapes in her hand, and she slapped it irritably away.
You know I wouldn't. Ian, what were you thinking? Roger will have a fit.
Her cousin seemed to find the notion funny. His mouth turned up at the corner.
A fit? Roger Mac?
I shouldn't think so.
Well, all right, he won't throw a fit, but he'll be worried.
And Jemmy will miss me.
No, they'll be all right, Ian assured her. I told Uncle Jimmy we'd be gone 3 days, and he said he'd bring the wain up to the big house, with your mam and Lizzie and Mrs. Bug to fuss over him. Wee Jem won't even notice you're gone.
This was likely true, but did nothing to assuage her annoyance.
You told Da? And he just said, fine, and both of you thought it was perfectly all right to lug me off into the woods for 3 days without telling me what was going on? You
high-handed, insufferable, beastly Scots, Ian said,
in such a perfect imitation of her mother's English accent that she burst out laughing, despite her annoyance.
Yes, she said, wiping spluttered grape juice off her chin. Exactly.
He was still smiling, but his expression had changed. He wasn't teasing any more.
Brianna, he said softly, with that Highland lilt that made of her name something strange and graceful. It's important, aye?
He wasn't smiling at all now. His eyes were fixed on hers, warm but serious. His hazel eyes were the only feature of any beauty about Ian Murray's face. But they held a gaze of such frank, sweet openness that you felt he had let you look inside his soul just for an instant. She had had occasion before to wonder whether he was aware of this particular effect, but even if he was, it was difficult to resist.
All right, she said, and waved away a circling wasp, still cross but resigned. All right. But you still should have told me. And you won't tell me? Even now?
He shook his head, looking down at the grape he was thumbing loose from its stem.
I can't, he said simply.
He flipped the grape into his mouth and turned to open his bag, which, now that she noticed, bulged suspiciously.
Do you want some bread, cuz? Or a bit of cheese?
No. Let's go.
She stood up and brushed dead leaves from her breeches. The sooner we get there, the sooner we'll be back. They stopped an hour before sunset, while enough light remained to gather wood. The bulging knapsack had proved to contain 2 blankets, as well as food and a jug of beer. Welcome after the day's walking, which had been mostly uphill.
"Oh, this is a good batch," she said approvingly, sniffing at the edge of the jug after a long, aromatic, hop-edged swallow.
"Who made it?"
"Lizzie. She caught the knack of it from Frau Uter before the,
A delicate Scottish noise encompassed the painful circumstances surrounding the dissolution of Lizzie's betrothal.
That was too bad, wasn't it?
She lowered her lashes, watching him covertly to see whether he would say anything further about Lizzie. Lizzie and Ian had seemed fond of each other once, but first he had gone to the Iroquois, and then she had been engaged to Manfred MacGillivray when he returned. Now that both of them were free once more... He dismissed her comment about Lizzie with nothing more than a shrug of agreement, though, concentrating on the tedious process of fire-making. The day had been warm, and an hour of daylight remained, but the shadows under the trees were already blue. The night would be chilly. "I'm going to have a look at the stream," she announced, plucking a coiled line and hook from the small pile of effects Ian had unloaded from his bag. "It looked like there's a trout pool just below the bend, and the flies will be rising."
"Oh, aye."
He nodded, but paid her little attention, patiently scraping the pile of kindling a little higher before striking the next shower of sparks from his flint. As she made her way around the bend of the little creek, she saw that it wasn't merely a trout pool. It was a beaver pond. The humped mound of the lodge was reflected in still water, and on the far bank she could see the agitated judderings of a couple of willow saplings, evidently in the process of being consumed. She moved slowly, a wary eye out. Beavers wouldn't trouble her, but they would make a dash for the water if they saw her, not only splashing, but smacking the water with their tails in alarm. She'd heard it before. It was amazingly loud, sounding like a fusillade of gunshots, and guaranteed to scare every fish within miles into hiding. Gnawed sticks littered the near bank, the white inner wood chiselled as neatly as any carpenter could do, but none was fresh, and she heard nothing nearby but the sigh of wind in the trees. Beavers weren't stealthy. None was close. With a cautious eye on the far bank, she baited the hook with a small chunk of cheese, whirled it slowly overhead, picking up speed as she let the line out, then let fly. The hook landed with a small plop in the middle of the pond, but the noise wasn't sufficient to alarm the beavers. The willow saplings on the far bank continued to shake and heave under the assault of industrious teeth. The evening hatch was rising, just as she'd told Ian. The air was soft, cool on her face, and the surface of the water dimpled and glimmered like grey silk shaken in light. Small clouds of gnats drifted in the still air under the trees, prey for the rising of the carnivorous caddisflies, stoneflies, and damselflies, breaking free of the surface, new-hatched and ravenous. It was a pity that she hadn't a casting rod or tied flies, but still, worth a try. Caddisflies weren't the only things that rose hungry at twilight, and voracious trout had been known to strike at almost anything that floated in front of them. Her father had once taken one with a hook adorned with nothing more than a few knotted strands of his own bright hair. That was a thought. She smiled to herself, brushing back a wisp of hair that had escaped from its plait, and began to draw the line slowly back toward shore. But there were likely more than trout here, and cheese was... A strong tug came on the line, and she jerked in surprise. A snag? The line jerked back, and a thrill from the depth shot up her arm like electricity. The next half hour passed without conscious thought, in the single-minded pursuit of finny prey. She was wet to mid-thigh, rashed with mosquito bites, and her wrist and shoulder ached. But she had three fat fish gleaming in the grass at her feet, a hunter's sense of profound satisfaction, and a few more crumbs of cheese left in her pocket. She was drawing back her arm to throw the hook again when a sudden chorus of squeaks and hisses shattered the evening calm, and a stampede of beavers broke from cover, trundling down the opposite bank of the pond like a platoon of small furry tanks. She stared at them, open-mouthed, and took a step back in reflex. Then something big and dark appeared among the trees behind the beaver, and further reflex shot adrenaline through her limbs as she whirled to flee. She would have been into the trees and away in an instant had she not stepped on one of her fish, which slid under her foot like greased butter and dumped her unceremoniously on her backside. From which position she was ideally placed to see Rollo race from the trees in a long, low streak and launch himself in an arching parabola from the top of the bank. Graceful as a comet, he soared through the air and landed in the pond among the beavers with a splash like a fallen meteor. Ian looked up at her, open-mouthed. Slowly his eyes travelled from her dripping hair, over her sopping, mud-smeared clothes, and down to the fish, one slightly squashed, that dangled from a leather string in her hand.
"The fish put up a good fight, did they?" he asked, nodding at the string.
The corners of his mouth began to twitch. "Yes," she said, and dropped them on the ground in front of him. "But not nearly as good a fight as the beavers."
"Beavers?" he said.
He rubbed a knuckle meditatively down the bridge of his long, bony nose.
"Aye, I heard them slapping.
You've been fighting beavers?"
"I've been rescuing your wretched dog from beavers," she said, and sneezed.
She sank to her knees in front of the new-made fire and closed her eyes in momentary bliss at the touch of heat on her shivering body.
"Oh, Rollo's back, then. Rollo! Where are you, hound?"
The big dog slunk reluctantly out of the shrubbery, tail barely twitching in response to his master's call.
"What's this I hear about beavers, then, Navadi?"
Ian said sternly. In response, Rollo shook himself, though no more than a fine mist of water droplets rose from his coat. He sighed, dropped to his belly, and put his nose morosely on his paws.
Maybe he was only after fish, but the beavers didn't see it that way. They ran from him on shore, but once he was in the water...
Brianna shook her head and wrang out the soggy tail of her hunting shirt.
"I tell you what, Ian, you clean those damn fish!"
He was already doing so, gutting one with a single neat slice up the belly and a scoop of the thumb. He tossed the entrails toward Rollo, who merely let out another sigh and seemed to flatten against the dead leaves, ignoring the treat.
"He's no hurt, is he?" Ian asked, frowning at his dog.
She glared at him.
"No, he isn't. I expect he's embarrassed. You could ask whether I'm hurt. Do you have any idea what kind of teeth beavers have?"
The light was nearly gone, but she could see his lean shoulders shaking.
"Aye," he said, sounding rather strangled. "I have. They, didn't bite you, did they? I mean, I should think it would be noticeable if you'd been gnawed."
A small wheeze of amusement escaped him, and he tried to cover it with a cough.
"No," she said, rather coldly.
The fire was going well, but not nearly well enough. The evening breeze had come up and was reaching through the soaked fabric of shirt and breeches to fondle her backside with ice-cold fingers.
"It wasn't so much the teeth as the tails," she said, shuffling round on her knees to present her back to the fire.
She rubbed a hand gingerly over her right arm, where one of the muscular paddles had struck flat on her forearm, leaving a reddened bruise that stretched from wrist to elbow. For a few moments, she'd thought the bone was broken.
"It was like being hit with a baseball bat. With a club, I mean," she amended. "The beavers hadn't attacked her directly, of course, but being in the water with a panicked wolf dog and half a dozen 60-pound rodents in a state of extreme agitation had been rather like walking through an automated car wash on foot, a maelstrom of blinding spray and thrashing objects." A chill struck her, and she wrapped both arms around herself, shivering.
"Here, cuz."
Ian stood up and skinned the buckskin shirt off over his head.
"Put this on."
She was much too cold and battered to refuse the offer. Retiring modestly behind a bush, she stripped off the wet things and emerged a moment later, clad in Ian's buckskin, one of the blankets wrapped around her waist, sarong-style.
"You don't eat enough, Ian,"
she said, sitting down by the fire again and eyeing him critically.
"All your ribs show."
They did. He'd always been lean to the point of thinness, but in his younger years his teenage scrawniness had seemed quite normal, merely the result of his bones outstripping the growth of the rest of him. Now he had reached his full growth and had had a year or two to let his muscles catch up. They had. She could see every sinew in his arms and shoulders, but the knobs of his spine bulged against the tan skin of his back, and she could see the shadow of his ribs like rippled sand under water. He raised a shoulder, but made no reply, intent on skewering the cleaned fish on peeled willow twigs for broiling.
"And you don't sleep very well, either."
She narrowed her eyes at him across the fire. Even in this light, the shadows and hollows in his face were obvious, despite the distraction of the mohawk tattoos that looped across his cheekbones. The shadows had been obvious to everyone for months. Her mother had wanted to say something to Ian, but Jamie had told her to let the lad be. He would speak when he was ready.
"Oh, well enough," he murmured, not looking up.
Whether he was ready now or not, she couldn't say. But he'd brought her here. If he wasn't ready, he could bloody well get that way, fast. She had, of course, wondered all day about the mysterious goal of their journey and why she was his necessary companion. For a matter of hunting, Ian would have taken one of the men. Good as she was with a gun, several of the men on the ridge were better, including her father. And any one of them would be better suited than she to something like digging out a bear's den, or packing home meat or hides. They were in the Cherokee lands at the moment. She knew Ian visited the Indians frequently, and was on good terms with several villages. But if it had been a matter of some formal arrangement to be made, surely he would have asked Jamie to accompany him, or Peter Bewley, with his Cherokee wife, to interpret. "Ian," she said, with the tone in her voice that could bring almost any man up short. "Look at me." His head jerked up, and he blinked at her. "Ian," she said, a little more gently, "is this to do with your wife?" He stayed frozen for a moment, eyes dark and unfathomable. Rollo, in the shadows behind him, suddenly raised his head and let out a small whine of inquiry. That seemed to rouse Ian. He blinked and looked down. "Aye," he said, sounding quite matter-of-fact. "It is." He adjusted the angle of the stick he had driven into the earth by the fire. The pale flesh of the fish curled and sizzled, browning on the green wood. She waited for him to say more, but he didn't speak, just broke off the edge of a piece of half-cooked fish and held it out to the dog, clicking his tongue in invitation. Rollo rose and sniffed Ian's ear in concern, but then deigned to take the fish and lay down again, licking the hot tidbit delicately before scooping it up with his tongue, gathering enough spirit then to engulf the discarded heads and fish guts as well. Ian pursed his lips a little, and she could see the thoughts flickering half-formed across his face, before he made up his mind to speak.
"I did once think of marrying you, you ken."
He gave her a quick, direct glance, and she felt an odd little jolt of realization. He'd thought about it all right, and while she had no doubt that his offer then had been made from the purest of motives, he was a young man. She hadn't until this moment realized that he would, of course, have contemplated every detail of what that offer entailed. His eyes held hers in wry acknowledgement of the fact that he had indeed imagined the physical details of sharing her bed, and had not found the prospect in any way objectionable. She resisted the impulse to blush and look away. That would discredit them both. She was suddenly, and for the first time, aware of him as a man rather than as an endearing young cousin, and aware of the heat of his body that had lingered in the soft buckskin when she pulled it on. "It wouldn't have been the worst thing in the world," she said, striving to match his matter-of-fact tone. He laughed, and the stippled lines of his tattoos lost their grimness. "No," he said. "Maybe not the best. That would be Roger Mack, aye? But I'm glad to hear I wouldn't have been the worst, either. Better than Ronnie Sinclair, do you think? Or worse than Forbes the lawyer?"
"Ha, bloody ha!"
She refused to be discomposed by his teasing. "You would have been at least third on the list."
"Third?"
That got his attention.
"What? Who was second?"
He actually seemed miffed at the notion that someone might precede him. And she laughed.
"Lord John Grey."
"Oh?
Oh, well. Aye, I suppose he'd do," Ian admitted grudgingly. "Though, of course, he..."
He stopped abruptly and darted a cautious look in her direction. She felt an answering stab of caution. Did Ian know about John Grey's private tastes? She thought he must, from the odd expression on his face. But if not, it was no place of hers to be revealing Lord John's secrets.
"Have you met him?" she asked curiously.
Ian had gone with her parents to rescue Roger from the Iroquois, before Lord John had appeared at her aunt's plantation, where she had met the nobleman herself.
"Oh, aye."
He was still looking wary, though he had relaxed a little.
"Some years ago, him and his, son, a stepson, I mean. They came to the ridge, travelling through to Virginia, and stopped a bit. I gave him the measle.
He grinned quite suddenly.
Or at least he had the measle. Auntie Claire nursed him through it. You've met the man yourself, though.
Yes, at River Run. Ian, the fish is on fire.
It was, and he snatched the stick from the flames with a small Gaelic exclamation, waving scorched fingers to cool them. Extinguished in the grass, the fish proved to be quite edible, if a little crispy round the edges, and a tolerably good supper, with the addition of bread and beer. "Did you meet Lord John's son, then, at River Run?" he asked, resuming their conversation. "Willie, his name is. A nice wee lad."
"He fell into the privy," he added thoughtfully.
"Fell in the privy?" she said, laughing.
"He sounds like an idiot. Or was he just quite small?"
"No, a decent size for his age.